Well, I should say, first of all, this is going to be a talk rather different in style from the rest during the week. You leave the physical reality at coffee time, but in this talk, I shall try and give you some impressionistic view of what astronomers have learnt about the possible existence of black holes in the actual universe. And let me say, I hope everyone will feel free to interrupt during the talk, because what I'm going to say will be perhaps more empirical than most people's normal work style here is in the conference. Well, I want to talk about three things. First, the evidence for black holes of different masses, and then the separate question about, do we really know that they are the black holes which relativists talk about, rather than just deep gravitational pits? And then I'll talk in particular about mergers and coalescence events, because these are important as ways of building up big black holes from small ones, and also as sources of gravitational wave events. Well, there are really three classes of gravitational wave of black holes which are discussed. There are black holes of general stellar masses, weighing a few times or up to 100 times as much as the mass of the Sun, which are formed as the endpoint of stellar evolution. There are certainly, as I'll say later, massive holes, the ones at the bottom, of masses up to a billion suns in the centers of galaxies. There may or may not be something in between. Black holes too big to be the remnants of ordinary stars, but not as big as the ones in galactic nuclei. I'll allude to them towards the end. But just to remind you, I think probably most people are familiar with the idea that there has been, for at least 20 years, evidence that there are black holes produced as the endpoint of stellar evolution. These may exist in huge numbers in our galaxy, but they're rather hard to detect, because if they are isolated in interstellar space, they don't do very much. But again, as I think probably most people know, there have been a number of cases found when there are black holes in orbit around an ordinary companion star. And this allows you to estimate their masses by simple Newtonian arguments, and the masses are between 5 and 20 solar masses for these objects. And also, they're detected because they are generally powerful X-ray sources. The X-rays arising almost certainly from gas captured from the companion, which swirls down into the black hole, getting very hot as it does so. So there's fairly good evidence that there are black holes in our galaxy, which are manifesting themselves by accretion of X-rays from their companion star. But of course, the black holes which we observe in these binaries are a small and atypical fraction of the total, much larger population of stellar mass black holes in our galaxy, because 99.99% are probably isolated objects in our galaxy which would only be accreting at a very tiny rate from the diffuse interstellar medium surrounding them. So there are probably many millions anyway of these stellar mass remnants. Well, are we surprised that there should be these remnants? The way they are thought to form is via supernova explosions. Massive stars end their lives as supernovae, very complicated physics depicted in this sort of cartoon here. What happens during the explosions? And most of the mass is blown off, and when the total mass of the star is below about 20 solar masses, it's thought that what is left behind is a neutron star. But if the total mass of the original star was very high, then enough material falls down onto the star, or stellar remnant, to produce a compact object too massive to be a stable neutron star, an object which therefore collapses to make a black hole. And this is a rather complicated diagram which summarizes what we've learned from stellar evolution about the masses of the remnants of stars as a function of the original mass. So what's plotted along here is the original mass of the star in solar masses, there's a line there. And what's plotted here is the mass of the remnant. And stars up to about 8 or 10 solar masses lose enough mass during their lifetime to end up as white dwarfs. They don't even give a supernova. And then between 10 and 20 or 30, you get the scenario as on the previous slide, where you get a neutron star. But above 30 solar masses, then it's thought that the infall onto the neutron star pushes the mass of the compact remnant above the neutron star limiting mass. That neutron star limiting mass is not as well known as the famous Chandrasekhar limit for white dwarfs because of the uncertain physics, but it is almost certainly not much more than 2 solar masses, certainly less than 3 solar masses. And all the black hole binaries, so-called, do have masses which are well above the 3 solar masses. So they can't be neutron stars. I'll come back towards the end of my talk to say things relevant to these very high mass objects which might be made in the early universe, but the situation is that from initial masses of 25 or so up to 100 or so, we expect that most of the remnant mass will be a black hole. There's an interesting region here where you get no remnant at all. What happens is that the star goes unstable to an effect arising from electron-positron pair production, and the whole thing is blown apart. So massive stars in the range of 150 to 250 solar masses leave no remnant at all, but if there were any stars, as there might have been in the early universe, of above 250 solar masses, then they will leave black hole remnants. But as I say, the black holes that we have evidence for in our galaxy in the binaries are of masses, the remnant masses are between 3 and 10 or so, and they're thought to be the remnants of massive stars which became supernovae. And this much is fairly well understood. Now, what we really like to do is detect one of these black holes actually forming, because it would then be a very spectacular event, and it would even perhaps give rise to gravitational waves. And in the last few years, we have realized that there is a class of objects which signal the formation of an unusual kind of black hole. And these are a particular kind of supernova which gives rise to a so-called gamma ray burst. And a gamma ray burst, observationally, is an object which releases a hugely luminous flash of gamma rays, about 10 to the 51 ergs, which is more than the sun radiates in its entire lifetime, in a few seconds, coming out in a beam of gamma rays. And over the last decade, several thousand, or at least nearly 3,000 gamma ray bursts have been detected from over the sky. They are detected by particularly a satellite with an instrument called MATSI, and they are seen over the entire sky, and these are objects which are so bright that they're detected out to cosmological distances. The distribution over the sky is isotropic, and each of these events, observed at a rate of one per day, is one of these gamma ray bursts. Now, one per day seems a lot, but in fact these events are much rarer than ordinary supernovae, because out to the range at which you can detect these redshifts of 4.5, there are literally billions of galaxies. So to get one event per day, you only need about one event per million years per galaxy. And that's about 10 to the fourth times rarer than supernova explosions. If you could detect supernovae, themselves fairly spectacular events, out to these redshifts, there'd be a few every minute. So these events are rare compared to supernovae. And crudely speaking, what's happening is that these are supernova explosions where a black hole is forming and there's an unusual amount of rotation. So that what happens is that there's a black hole which produces the very intense radiation, MEV photons, in the core. And in a normal supernova, these photons have to random walk out to the surface of a star, and they escape in ordinary light over the light curve of a supernova which rises and falls over a few weeks. But in this case, the star is spinning, and this material squirts directly out, makes a channel for itself along the axis, and you get these two jets, so you get MEV radiation released within a few seconds, coming straight out in a beam. And this beam, if it points towards you, gives you an event which outshines anything in the universe. And that's what we believe is happening in a gamma ray burst. It signals the collapse of the core of a star to make a black hole, probably a spinning black hole. Material in the immediate vicinity of that black hole swirls down onto it and produces this immense luminosity lasting a few seconds, and it makes a channel for itself and escapes along the axis. This is just another cartoon showing what happens, precursor massive star, which has a lifetime of about a few million years. It blows off its outer envelope, leaves about 10 solar masses, and then it produces this this core here, with stuff spinning around outside it. And then you get some action. Radiation which is produced in this core forces its way out along the path of least resistance, which is along the rotation axis, and squirts out, and then is observed here if we are in the line of sight. So in working out the statistics for gamma ray bursts, number of gamma ray bursts is probably 100 or 1,000 times larger than the ones observed to allow for the fact that we only see them if we happen to be in the cone angle which gives the intense emission. And there's lots of debate about how wide that cone is and what it correlates with, and that's a subject in itself which I won't go into. But gamma ray bursts are objects which signal almost certainly the formation of a black hole in some subclass of supernovae. And these objects really are fascinating because they manifest such extreme physics, magnetic fields of 10 to the 11th Tesla, energy releases, which are, as I say, at the rate of 10 to the 51 ergs per second, which is an entire solar lifetime energy output in a second or so. I should mention, in parenthesis, that we now believe there are two different categories of gamma ray bursts. Two-thirds of the observed ones, which have gamma ray flashes lasting a few seconds, are believed to be interpreted in the way I've just indicated. But there's another class of gamma ray bursts which we believe is different, which is even shorter, 1 or 2 seconds at most. And it's thought that these arise as the outcome of a process which we know must be happening in the universe, namely the merger of two neutron stars. Everyone's probably heard of the famous binary pulsar, which is the two neutron stars in orbit which are gradually falling together because of gravitational radiation emission and will eventually coalesce into a phenomenon where two neutron stars merge together to make a black hole. And this is an event which we know must be happening, and this you would expect to give an even shorter gamma ray burst than the other ones, because the debris is, as it were, naked. It doesn't have to forge its way out through the envelope of a star. The neutron stars would merge, you'd get a black hole, debris would swirl into it, and this would be a compact and sudden event. And the rate of these events is somewhat less, probably, than the rate of the other events. But we can estimate this because we know how many of these binary neutron stars there are in our galaxy. I should mention that gamma ray bursts have been studied for 30 years. They were detected, as you probably know, in the late 1960s by Americans using the so-called Vela satellites, which had been developed to detect clandestine Soviet nuclear tests in space. In the late 1960s, Americans, based at Los Alamos, started to detect some flashes, and it took them 2 or 3 years to convince themselves that these were not sinister but were natural phenomena. And in 1973, the first paper was published reporting these flashes of gamma rays coming from random points in the sky. in the 1970s and 80s, there was tremendous confusion. No one knew how far away they were. Some people thought they were fairly local objects, or neutron stars burping in our galaxy, or something like that. But it became clear after the launch of the BATSE in 1992, with a large sample uniformly distributed over the sky, that these were extragalactic phenomena, and now about 20 or 30 have been identified with objects in galaxies. And I mentioned here a satellite launched just in the last year called the SWIFT satellite, which is primarily NASA, but large participation from Leicester University here in particular. And this is a satellite which is going to be studying gamma ray bursts. And the advantage this will have is that it can pinpoint the position of the gamma ray burst quickly and accurately. The problem with previous gamma ray detectors was that they gave a rather poor location, and it was not possible therefore immediately to follow up the gamma ray detection by looking in other wave bands, X-rays, optical, infrared, etc. This telescope will be able to pinpoint a gamma ray burst and then slew within a minute of time to pin down the position a few minutes, better than a minute of arc. And therefore, it'll be possible to observe the immediate aftermath of the gamma ray burst in other wave bands, which has not been possible up till now. So what's this space? We'll understand a lot better about gamma ray bursts, particularly the short ones, in a couple of years when data comes through from SWIFT, which has been gathering data for just 6 months. The first paper based on its data was in Nature just last week. Well, I want to turn now to talk. Could I say, first of all, please interrupt with questions, because I'm going to slightly switch topic from stellar mass black holes to big ones. So please interrupt. I'm now going to talk about the evidence for black holes in the centers of galaxies. Here's the Andromeda Galaxy. It's basically an assemblage of stars and gas, but we now know that there is a central dark object weighing, in the case of this object, about 3 times 10 to the 7th solar masses. And this object is almost certainly something which answers the description of a black hole. And I'll just show you a cartoon. This is a picture. A publicity picture which shows what you would see if you were to zoom in onto a galaxy like Andromeda and get really close up. You would see gas swirling down into some central object. And of course, the key question for this conference is, what is the nature of that central object? What's the metric around it? What are the flow patterns near it? Can we actually assume that they are as calculated on the basis of the Kerr metric? Well, let me show you some of the evidence for the existence of these central objects. I should say that we have pretty good evidence for these black holes in probably 50 plus nearby galaxies. We have circumstantial evidence for a lot more. But there are two cases where we have remarkably good evidence, which I want to show because it's a real technical achievement in astronomy to have got this evidence. This is the galaxy called NGC 4258, which is about 20 or 30 million light years away from the Earth. And it has in its center a object which is squirting out a jet. What's been discovered is that it has orbiting around this central object is a disk, which we now know is a Keplerian-type disk, which is slightly tilted. That's a sort of refinement. And the amazing thing about this, if you look at the scale here, this shows the scale from there to there. This is milli-arc seconds. So this is a resolution. This entire system here is 1,000 times smaller than the smallest thing you can resolve with a big optical telescope on the ground. This is amazing resolution. And so this is done by radio astronomers using very long baseline interferometry, combining together radio telescopes across a continent or on different continents. And they've been able to get this amazing sharp imaging. And nature was very lucky in this particular, was very kind to us in this particular case, because this disk of rather cool gas is emitting in a very strong line, which is actually a line at 1.35 centimeters, which is due to the water molecule, H2O. And this is actually acting like a maser. And so you get a very sharp line at a well-known microwave frequency, and you can therefore get the Doppler effect very sharply. You can get the velocity of each little emitting region to 1 kilometer per second, and that again is much sharper resolution than you can get from an optical spectral line. So you have 1,000 times the best resolution in the optical, and much better spectral resolution too. And this shows separate little spots that were detected here and their velocity. And that is a Keplerian law, going as r to the minus a half, and there. And that's a linear law. Well, it's rather remarkable, the physics of this. Because it's a maser, then of course you get the biggest gain, where's the biggest path length for the smallest velocity gradient. And therefore, the maser highlights for you the tangential point. So the radiation we see here comes from the tangent there. So that's why we know we're seeing the tangential velocity, and this here comes from the inner edge there. So from this marvelous observation, we can infer a disk and its mass of the central object is known. Of course, there's uncertainties in the distance, so actually this has now been inverted to give us perhaps the best way to determine the distance of an object if we know its mass, because we have an angular scale and we have a velocity, so we know a mass divided by a distance. So this is a remarkable piece of luck that nature has provided, this almost edge-on disk with the maser lines, this is a central object. The other remarkably compelling case for a black hole is in the center of our galaxy. Our galaxy is rather underprivileged, and it has a far smaller black hole than most galaxies, but it has a central object which has been known for 20 or 30 years to be a small, unusual radio source. And the problem with our galactic center is, of course, that when you look in the plane of our galaxy, there's dust which prevents you seeing with an ordinary optical telescope into the center. But two things have happened. First, it's been possible to observe in the near infrared at 2 microns, when it's possible to see through the dust, because dust is much more transparent at wavelengths much longer than the typical grain sizes. And so at 2 microns, one can see inwards. And also, it's been possible at 2 microns with the two biggest telescopes in the world, the Very Large Telescope in Chile, European Southern Observatory, and the Keck Telescope in Hawaii, to actually use optical techniques to sharpen up the image and to get an angular resolution of about 10 to the minus 2 arc seconds, and to observe individual stars very close to the galactic center, stars within 1 or 2 arc seconds of the galactic center. And when these stars are observed at different times, they're found to have moved. And this picture shows data accumulated over the last decade by these techniques on a number of stars. And one also has their radio velocity towards us from the spectrum. So we have three-dimensional, most of which aren't shown here. But essentially, we see they've moved, people have been able to track out the orbits of these objects around the center. And this one here is the one on an orbit with about a 15-year period. So one has seen this go almost all the way around the central object. And these other ones, you see only part of an orbit, but you have enough data to actually fit elliptical orbits and show that these are all consistent with a set of elliptical orbits around a point mass. This is picture of the smallest orbit. There's a central object. This is where the radio source is. It doesn't look at the focus, but remember this is in oblique, and it's not a it's not in the plane of the screen. This actually isn't a focus. And now there are observations going for another nearly 3 years going up here. And so this is a star which has been observed orbiting a central mass, and this mass is about 3 million suns. Now, these two cases, the galaxy NGC 4258 and its galactic center, give very good evidence for a concentrated mass. You can test the deviation from the inverse square law to say how much distributed mass there is, etc. And so these are good evidence for there being a central point mass. But, of course, the evidence here, the precise evidence, comes from the Newtonian regime. The inner part of the disk on NGC 4258 is still only moving at 1,000 kilometers per second, so it's a tenth to the fifth gravitational radii. And here, this star here, which it zooms by this point at 10,000 kilometers per second. But that's still 1,000 times the Schwarzschild radius. And so these observations, though they're telling us as a concentrated mass, are not telling us anything about relativity. Certainly nothing about the about the form of the metric. And so let me now turn to the evidence that we do have that pertains to closer in. Of course, we do have some evidence, because if we see luminosity, which we think is due to accretion on a black hole, then almost certainly that comes from gas swirling in, and in any kind of deep potential, the luminosity comes mainly from the center. So we do have indirect evidence for that, but can we do better than that? Before that, let me just say that there is not just evidence from those two galaxies, but from quite large numbers of galaxies for central point masses. And the evidence is just Newtonian evidence. You have gas or stars orbiting around, and you infer the central mass. One thing we've learned in the last few years is that rather than these being unusual phenomena in galaxies, there are black holes in the centers of almost all galaxies. And moreover, the black hole seems to know what sort of galaxy it's in. I won't go into this, but these are correlations between the mass of the black hole and the mass of the bulge of the galaxy and the velocity dispersion there. And so it does seem as though there's some connection. Size of the nature of the galaxy determines how big the black hole grows, or some people argue it's the other way around, that the black hole determines how big the galaxy grows. That's another matter for debate. But there are black holes in almost all galaxies, which are the relic of some kind of activity when the galaxy was having a quasar in its center. And the remnant of that is a black hole. We know that these exist in most big galaxies, ellipticals, and in disk galaxies. We don't yet know whether there are black holes in very small galaxies. Just a bit of history. The first papers to talk about black holes were in the 1960s. In fact, Zeldovich and Novikov in 1964, when quasars were discovered, suggested that they involved accretion onto black holes of 10th day solar masses. But to support local colleagues, a real classic paper was by Donnellan and Bell in 1969, where he was the first to calculate some of these processes around black holes and to make the point that from what we knew about quasars, it was quite likely that there would be, in the centers of most galaxies, a black hole which was the remnant of past activity. Because if you have a quasar which involves gas swirling down into a black hole, then the gas supply can be turned off, but you're still left with a black hole. And Donald has proved to be right in that in most galaxies there are black holes which are not accreting very much gas, but they are still there, as detected by motions around them. And so this was a really prescient paper now 35 years ago. We still don't know how the black holes form. This is actually from a paper I wrote about 25 years ago, which was what seemed then to be the various ways in which a big black hole could form. Don't worry about the details. The only points that I emphasized back then was that there were lots of processes that could happen in the center of a galaxy. Dense star clusters could lead to collisions, gas could accumulate, etc. But my point then was the bottom line, which was that all these routes would almost automatically lead to a massive black hole. And so once you get a large amount of mass in the potential well at the bottom of a galaxy, it seems almost inevitable that a large fraction of that gas is going to accumulate in a black hole. But when I wrote this paper, we didn't know, and we still don't know really, which of the routes is the most likely one. Is it the case that a small black hole grows exponentially by swallowing up gas? Are there successive mergers of small holes? Could it be that stars in a dense cluster coalesce and build up a very massive star, which then goes unstable for post-Newtonian reasons? Could it be that the gas accumulates directly in the center to make a supermassive star? We just don't know. I think all those are possible, and we have more data now on the mass distribution of black holes and things about their redshift distribution, which will help us to solve these problems. Now, let me now ask the question, what about the metric near the black holes? This is a quote from a general lecture given by Chandra, where he was expressing his amazement that there were actually in nature zillions of objects described exactly by the equations of relativity, the equation of the Kerr metric. Now, we have to say that although we all believe this, we don't actually know very well that the Kerr metric actually applies, essentially because we don't have the kind of data we'd like to have about the relativistic domain very close in. But let me just mention what we would like, what we can find already. Obviously, we'd like to get a really close-up image. We'd like to see a star processing on a relativistic orbit or something like that. But let me just say what's the best we can do up till now. Oh, well, this is just to remind me that although I'm now going to focus on supermassive stars, supermassive black holes, in effect, there's a simple scaling law. If you compare a stellar mass black hole with a black hole weighing a billion solar masses, then the physics around it is rather similar if you scale up the accretion rate in proportion to the mass. Everything happens slower in the big case, but the physics is basically similar. If you have two black holes, one a million times heavier than another, and you make the accretion rate a million times higher in one than the other, you get essentially the same physics, the same ratio of cooling time to dynamical time, the same ratio of radiation pressure to gravity, and so essentially we can interchangeably talk about the problem of flow around stellar mass black holes and supermassive black holes. Well, if we could really get close up to a black hole or get an immensely sharp image of a black hole with gas flowing around it, we'd see something like this. This shows, this is an artist's cartoon, as it were, of gas circling around a black hole and seen obliquely. And what you would see is that it'd be blue on one side, coming towards you, red on the other. This feature here, which you would see in principle, this is the underside of the front part of the disk where the light has been round the back over the top and produces an arc. So you can calculate what you would see if you were to have enough angular resolution to probe the relativistic domain around a black hole and see the spectacular light bending, etc. Now, of course, we can't do that, but we can do something which probes the gas, and that is we can study the emission from this gas, and if this gas emits a spectral line, then we can learn something about the motions. And this is just, again, a cartoon. If you look at a gas as a disk obliquely, then in Newtonian theory, if you have a ring, then and you submit a spectral line, then you will see something with two horns. You see the red tangentially one side, you get blue shift, one side you get a red shift. Putting in special relativity, aberration makes the blue shifted side brighter than the red shifted side. You put in general relativity, then you get the gravitational redshift superimposed, and also, of course, you get some light bending, which you'd have to allow for. And then, if you imagine that we are seeing not just a particular ring, but a disk where there's some surface brightness distribution at different radii, then you integrate over several things like this. Now, that's a cartoon, but one can do calculations in a bit more detail. This is some that we did about 15 years ago, it doesn't matter what these are. These are done for black holes with different A over M, different orientations, different disks. But the main feature is that you get a blue horn and a red horn, and you get a long tail of the line stretching away into the red. Now, X-ray astronomers can detect, in particular, a 6.4 kV line, which comes from iron with a single electron left. So it's a hydrogenic iron at the temperatures in these disks, which is about 10 kV. Most electrons stripped off, but iron retains its inner electron, and so you get the analog of Lyman alpha for iron, which is about 6.4 kV. And here's an example. This is my colleague Andy Fabian and his group, where they looked at the profile of the iron line from one particular object. And the quality of the data isn't marvelous, as you can see, but this is a 6.4 line, and so there's a peak here and a long tail. So the main point here is that the overall line is shifted, and that's primarily the gravitational redshift, and it is very, very broadened. And at the very least, this broadening indicates that the motion's about half the speed of light, since this broadening is mainly a Doppler effect. Now, what one would like to do is to use data like this to see if you can pin down the spin of the black hole, because, again, as you probably know, if you have a spinning black hole, then for co-rotating orbits, you get stability closer in. So you can get a bigger velocity and a bigger redshift for a curve. And Andy Fabian claims that his data already show that these can't be Schwarzschild black holes, must be spinning, because it would not be possible to get such a big extension to the red from a Schwarzschild black hole. I should say this is still a matter of debate because, of course, there may be other complications which make the simple disk model inappropriate. But in principle, this is a way whereby X-ray astronomers can probe data very close to a central black hole and learn something about the flow patterns. Of course, it would be even better if we had a star, which would behave in a more predictable way. But if we understood the gas dynamics, then we ought to be able to use these data to learn something about the metric in the relativistic domain. There's been a bit of setback, actually, in that the satellite that was going to be best at this, following up these two existing satellites, was a Japanese satellite, which was launched just a month ago, but sadly the helium was supposed to cool it down all leaked away, and so this won't give us the better data which Andy, Fabian and I were hoping for in this next year in this project. So that's a bad setback for the Japanese. Let me just mention another technique that's been adumbrated for probing black holes, and that's look at some X-ray sources. These are stellar mass X-ray sources where there are so-called quasi-periodic oscillations. Nothing as regular as a pulsar, but some sort of preferred oscillations. And the argument's been made that these oscillations may be some sort of pulsations in a disk. And if they are, you can, since you know the mass of the black hole, learn something about the spin, because calculations by Wagon and Novak and others, these just show as a function of the gravitational radius, the various epicyclic frequencies and modes will tend to be concentrated where they're maximal. And the main point here is that if you take Schwarzschild, A equals 0.5 and A equals 0.998, then it's a big difference in these curves, and therefore a black hole of given mass can give you higher frequency quasi-period oscillations if it's like this than if it's like this. Here again, one has to have not only the data, but be convinced that one is interpreting these pulsations in the right way, but in principle this is a diagnostic, which is about a factor of 5 difference between the characteristic frequencies of a non-spinning black hole and a rapidly spinning black hole of the same mass. Now, the most important and impressive feature of many putative black holes, especially in the sense of galaxies, is that they give rise to jets. Material flowing out at relativistic speeds, and of course the gamma ray bursts, so in a sense an example of this. The question is, how does the energy produced around a black hole get channeled into the form of a magnetized relativistic jet and maybe a pointing flux going along an axis? This has led to the interesting idea, which goes back to a paper by Blanford and Znaik in the mid-70s, and they pointed out how, by applying a magnetic field outside a spinning black hole, it's possible to get a physical realization of a so-called Penrose process, whereby one extracts the some of the spin energy of a black hole, slows down its spin. And the Penrose process had no physical realization when Roger proposed in 1969, but if there's an electromagnetic field, then you can get effects rather like what happens if you have a spinning conductor and you produce an EMF in a circuit and that gives a jet. And so this is a process which can give you energy from a spinning black hole in addition to from accretion. And moreover, the energy you get by this process will be mainly in electromagnetic fields, electron-positron pairs, etc., the kind of material that can give you a highly relativistic jet. Now, I think it's fair to say that we have no compelling evidence that any jets have to be powered this way, because you can't rule out a more conventional interpretation involving magnetic fields on an accretion disk, but it could be that in some of these radio jets and even gamma ray bursts, energy is being extracted from a spinning black hole. Now, just to finish off with, I want to say something in the cosmological context. This shows a picture, a survey from astronomers in Britain and Australia, which shows about 200,000 galaxies in slices of the northern and southern sky, showing how they're clustered. And I'll just show you this picture here. This is a picture taken at a very deep exposure, and this shows only a few square arc minutes. And this is an amazing picture, because every smudge here is a galaxy, galaxies mainly 10 billion light years or so away. So this will be a tiny patch of sky. It would take 100 patches like this to cover the full moon in the sky. This looks entirely blank, seen with a small telescope, but here you see all these smudges.
Why are there no stars in the foreground?
Why are there no stars? Actually, the density, if you look at this very faint, then galaxies greatly outnumber stars. If you were to do the number versus brightness of stars, they would indeed thin out. There may be one or two stars here, I don't know, but it's certainly the case that the if you extrapolate how many stars you would detect per square arc minute, if you went down to this is 29th magnitude, then they'd be far thinner on the sky than these, as you get to the edge of the galaxy. This just shows the spectra of some very distant objects. These are not normal galaxies. These are galaxies which are in the process of accreting and are behaving like quasars. But I show this because this is Lyman alpha emission. This is optical spectra, not X-rays this time. And Lyman alpha, which is normally in the far ultraviolet, 1216 angstrom, is shifted in these objects to about 9,000, the extreme red. So in this object, redshift 6.28, the wavelength is stretched by 7.28, which means that the scale factor of the universe was less by 7.28 when this light set out. So we're looking back to when the universe was maybe about a tenth of its present age in studying these objects. And here we see these objects at least already must have big black holes. In fact, conventional models suggest that there must be a black hole of a billion solar masses already present in these galaxies. But how did these black holes get there? Suppose we look back even further into space, further back into time, we'd expect we'd get to a time when there aren't any galaxies, when the galaxies haven't yet been assembled. So what can we say about that? Well, we know about the early universe from the microwave background. We know the initial fluctuations, simulations have been done to indicate how, starting with a universe containing just these small fluctuations, the metric fluctuations, as the universe expands, density contrasts are enhanced by gravity and structures develop. And I'll just show you a little movie here. You see the time in giga years, and this is a co-moving sphere, large enough to contain several hundred galaxies. You subtract the expansion subtracted out, but you see in this picture, as time goes on, structures develop. And this rotation is put in so you can see the 3D structure, but this indicates a phenomenon which is now well understood, that if you start off with fluctuations as the universe expands, over-dense regions lag behind more and more, and structures condense out. So what we expect is that galaxies form as some sort of hierarchical process. At very high redshifts, there's nothing, then there are sub-galaxies, and then they merge to make galaxies. And this suggests that we have to think about how big black holes might build up by mergers of smaller ones. If you have two galaxies which merge and each has a black hole in it, then the black holes will sink towards the center by dynamical friction on the stars. Then eventually gravitational radiation will make them coalesce. And we'd like to know how that happens. And in particular, we'd like to know whether these huge black holes, which exist in galaxies now, which in some cases I showed existed even a billion years after the Big Bang, whether those black holes, if we went back to still higher redshifts, would they have started off with stellar mass black holes building up like this? This is a simulation showing it says build up. Or did nothing start until you had, say, a million solar masses and then build up from there? This is an extreme hierarchical picture where you start from stellar mass objects. This is where you don't get any black holes until you get a million solar masses. And we don't know, because we don't know very much about what happened in the universe before a billion years at redshifts greater than 6. But we can say something about when the action would have started in the universe, because we know the nature of these fluctuations, and the simulations say that if you take the frames from that last movie, early on it looks smooth, and then you start getting fluctuations, and then they build up hierarchically. And you can ask, when would the first star start to form? And the answer is probably at a redshift of about 30, where gas would have started to condense into potential wells, and then you might get the first star. What we don't know is what these first stars were like. They would form in these small systems, smaller than galaxies, and it's not clear, but there's a strong reason to suspect that these stars would indeed be much more massive than present-day stars. One reason for that is that, the reason for that is that the gas is condensing at a much higher temperature than the gas in the Orion Nebula, where stars are now forming. In the Orion Nebula, the temperature is about 10 degrees Kelvin or less. Here, the temperature is much higher. It's higher for two reasons. First, at a redshift of 30, the microwave background is at about 90 degrees Kelvin, so everything's in a heat bath, can't get cooler than that. Also, there's only hydrogen and helium in the early universe, and that doesn't allow the kind of cooling processes which allow interstellar clouds to get very cool now. And when you have higher temperatures, then pressure is more important, and that inhibits fragmentation of gas into small pieces. So it would not be surprising if these first stars, the so-called population 3 stars, were indeed massive, though we don't really know. But going back to this picture, then it could be that we get produced at redshift of 20 some black holes here, and maybe even above 300 solar masses. And that's a very interesting question for the formation of black holes. So the kind of picture we might have for the formation of the kind of black holes which plainly exist at redshift of 6, to give the quasars, is what's shown in this sort of tree here, where here's a big black hole and there are various mergers here. Okay? But as I've indicated, we don't know quite how far back we can trace this. There is one interesting, let me measure two things. First, of course, how far back this can be traced is very important for gravitational wave detections, because every time there's a merger of a black hole, there's an event detectable by LISA, the gravitational wave detector in space, and how many events there are leading up to a galaxy now depends on how far back we can detect this merger tree. There's another interesting phenomenon here, which is, again, a challenge to numerical relativists, which is the issue of the gravitational wave recoil during a merger. If two black holes merge, suppose they're Schwarzschild black holes of unequal masses, then the final plunge is asymmetrical. There's a particular longitude where momentum is radiated. And so there's a typical kick or recoil, which people have tried to estimate, and maybe about 10 to the minus, a few times 10 to the minus 4 of the speed of light. The final momentum in the final plunge, emitted by the gravitational wave, has a small asymmetry, and that's enough to give a kick to the merged black hole. And the size of that kick is quite important, because if the recoil is, say, 100 kilometers per second, that exceeds the escape velocity from these little galaxies. And so if you had a merger at, say, a redshift of 10 between two small galaxies, you get two black holes merging into one, but that black hole would then be kicked out completely and would be lost from the game, so you would not have the hierarchical picture. So that's why in this diagram here, there's a possibility that these two black holes here are kicked out, and so there's no black hole here. And so the size of this recoil, which is a challenge to numerical relativists, is something which is very important for how this hierarchy went, and therefore for the formation of black holes. This is a paper by Scott Hughes, Favata et al., where they estimated what the uncertainty was. Won't go into the details, but in fact the velocity is about 100 kilometers per second, but it's pretty uncertain. It depends on the mass ratio. Obviously, two equal Schwarzschild black holes, by symmetry, there's no effect. If the ratio is 3:1, the effect's maximal, and is of that sort of order. If you have two spinning black holes, then there may be some spin-orbit coupling, so you get a recoil along the axis. That's even far from being calculable at the moment, but that, again, may be a larger effect. But these effects are very important for determining whether there are black holes hurtling through intergalactic space now or displaced from the centers of galaxies, or how efficient this merger process is. And, of course, detection of these supermassive black holes will have to await the LISA in space, because LIGO is sensitive to stellar mass objects around 100 hertz, whereas the lower frequency events will come from detected by LISA. But LISA ought to detect a fairly high range of events, and to show you here is the frequency range of LISA. There's a millihertz, minus 4, if you had a black hole of, say, 1,000 solar masses falling into 1 10 to the 5th solar masses, you'd start off a year before the coalescence, seeing it here, and then, a year before coalescence there, and then it would eventually be detected there. So you can see the final coalescence over quite a big range. And that's why the number of these intermediate black holes between, say, 100 and 10 to the 6th is very important, because we don't see them directly now. They can't arise from the kind of stars that form now, but events of when they fall into bigger black holes are going to dominate the event rate from LISA. I'm going to finish now, but just one final point, which is, can we say anything about the likely spin of black holes from astrophysical likelihood arguments? A over M determines the accretion efficiency, the minimum variability time scale, importance of Banff-Nyack, etc. What we can say is it depends, obviously, on how the black hole forms, but also on how it grows. Just show here some simulations. If black hole grows just by mergers, then you tend to build up the spin to about A over M of 50%. On the other hand, if the black hole grows by accretion from a systematically rotating disk, then obviously that tends to spin it up more. So the average A over M depends very much on the physics. I think I'll stop there, because if I had run out of time, I'd have gone more into cosmology, but let me stop there. But I hope I've indicated that black holes exist. We don't yet know very much about the metric close to the black hole, but it does affect a number of observables in X-ray astronomy and other wave bands, and also issues like the merger of two black holes are crucial for the event rate from LISA. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Martin. Are there any questions?
Is it a rule that at the center of the galaxy we should have a black hole?
It seems that in almost all big galaxies there is a black hole. Small galaxies we don't know, but it seems that there is a black hole in all the ones where we've looked, and that in itself is interesting because that sets some upper limit to the recoil in coalescence. Because if there were if a galaxy had undergone a recent merger and there'd been a recoil that kicked out the black hole, we'd expect to find a large galaxy with no black hole in it. We don't find that. So it does indeed seem that all galaxies have black holes in them, and moreover, the mass of the black hole does seem to be correlated with the size of the galaxy. And that's an important event for astronomers to explain. We don't quite know why that should be the case.
There's
some tentative evidence. There are some X-ray sources which have a luminosity and a spectrum which is best fit if they are a few hundred or a few thousand solar masses. So that's the best direct evidence. There's a debate because some people say, well, maybe they're lower mass black holes with a jet squirting towards us, which makes them look anomalous. But there are some X-ray astronomers who would claim that some of the sources they observe involve accretion onto a black hole that must be about 1,000 solar masses. Now, how do those black holes form? Two possibilities. One is that perhaps occasionally now stars form of 1,000 solar masses. Perhaps they form by coalescence of ordinary stars in a dense star cluster, and then you get a 1,000 solar mass star, which then evolves. That's a possibility. Or alternatively, if there are these black holes, they could be relics of this so-called population 3, the population of stars that formed early on that may well have been more massive. But I think the evidence is rather tentative, but it's very important for X-ray astronomers, but even more important for GR experts, because the LISA event rate would certainly be dominated by intermediate mass black holes falling into bigger black holes. Yes, you again.
You also mentioned how that small black holes can emerge into the very big black hole,
yes,
in the center of the galaxy.
Yes.
I'd like to ask about the reason for this emergency and about the processing.
Yes, the question is about whether very small black holes can grow and turn into very big ones. All I can say there is that in principle, there's a small black hole and it's fed with gas for long enough, then its mass could exponentiate. And it's possible in principle in the right environment that if you have a black hole in the center of a galaxy, when the galaxy is newly formed and it's been fed over its entire lifetime, then it could have grown from 100 solar masses up to a billion solar masses. That's possible. And so that's one of the possibilities, that a few favored small black holes find themselves in an environment where they grow a lot. So that's one way of getting big black holes. Another way is by mergers of small ones. And we don't know. Yeah. Well, we believe that any massive object will tend to settle towards the center by just equipartition arguments, okay? And that's the place where it's most likely to be embedded in a dense gas cloud. So if you want to find a place where a black hole is going to be able to grow, that's going to be in the center of a galaxy, okay? Now, that leads most of us to think that before you get black holes to grow, you must have some kind of galaxy which has formed during the expanding universe, as shown in that movie simulation, where gas and dark matter form bound systems, come into equilibrium, and then in the center the gas tends to settle.
And you also mentioned about the motion of the center of the galaxy.
Yes. Okay, but no, in the center of our galaxy, the black hole is... Yes, okay. She was asking about the orbits in the center of our galaxy. And black hole itself, which is associated with a faint radio source, does not seem to move at all. What is seen to move is a number of the stars, which are very close to it. And so those elliptical orbits I showed were stars, which are close to the center, just moving in ordinary ellipses. And the black hole itself, which weighs a million times as much, is essentially fixed in the center. And indeed, there are upper limits to the possible motion of that black hole, which do indeed corroborate the requirement for a high mass.
Yes. So what's the largest percentage of mass in a galaxy that's in the black hole? I mean, what's the range?
It's a fraction of 1%. There's the correlation which I showed in one of these pictures says that it's about 0.3% of the stellar mass of the galaxy which is in the black hole, we don't quite know how that's established, but it's very important that it's not important for dark matter, etc. But it is interesting that the role of black holes in the energy budget of the universe is comparable to that of stars, because stars would have a maximum efficiency of 0.7%, and in practice is about 0.1 or 0.2%, whereas black holes, if they've grown by accretion, have an efficiency of order 10%. So in terms of the energy input into the universe generally, it turns out, and this may or may not be a coincidence, that black holes have contributed about as much as stars.
Question, Martin. For relativists, the most exciting sort of black hole has not been one of these, but always one that might be about 10 to the 14 grams.
Right, yes.
What is the observational limit situation? Are there any prospects for improving sensitivity and probing that mass range?
Right. So John is talking about the mini black holes, which are undergoing Hawking evaporation, but haven't completed it. The situation there is that those below 10 to the 14 grams would have evaporated by now. We have constraints on masses up to about 10 to the 19. The reason for that is that black holes in that mass range would be emitting gamma rays. And we know that the gamma ray background is about 10 to the minus 8 or 10 to the minus 9 of the critical density. And so we have upper limits on black holes up to a range of 10 to the 19 grams. The other limit in the other direction is that from gravitational lensing limits, looking for evidence of lensing, we can constrain black holes down to about 10 to the minus 6 solar masses, which is about 10 to the 27 grams. Because if there were lots of those in our galactic halo, you would see lensing events which would have a shorter time scale than lensing by a stellar mass. And so, particularly from the French group working on gravitational lensing, there are limits down to that. So I think you're free to have as many black holes as you like to make up the dark matter, anywhere between about 10 to the 19 grams and 10 to the 27 grams. Although, of course, as you know, to imagine how they formed requires a fluctuation amplitude in the early universe, which is very different from what you get from inflation. You need to have fluctuations of order 10% on those mass scales. Malcolm.
In giving talks myself on this sort of subject to astronomical societies, the standard comeback is, yes, we agree there's a lot of mass in a small region, but how do you know that it's actually a black hole and that we have the right theory of gravity or a theory of gravity that predicts black holes?
Yes, yes.
You cited in particular the line profiles in the X-rays evidence, but you seem to suggest you didn't regard that as conclusive. What do you think are the strongest other things one can say?
I actually think that is the strongest evidence we have at the moment. If we could convince ourselves that Blanford's Nyack is applying, then that would be stronger. But I don't think we have any compelling cases. If we could convince ourselves there was a jet with no baryons in it and pure pointing flux, then that would perhaps show Blanford's and Arc's work. But I genuinely think that we have no stronger argument to give to a skeptic than the X-ray line profiles. Now, you have to ask, if it's not a black hole, what is it? I think we have fairly strong evidence that it's something with a horizon where gas can fall inside. If we had something with a hard surface, then I think we do have other constraints, because in some X-ray binaries, then you can show that you'd see something more conspicuous with a hard surface. And there's another line of argument, which is that if these aren't black holes, then what might they be? The most likely candidate I can think of would be a dense clump of collisionless dark matter. Let's suppose that the early universe had not just the Gaussian fluctuations that give the dark matter as in the simulations, but suppose there are a few regions where the dark matter is very overdense, so you end up with clumps of dark matter with a velocity dispersion of, say, 10,000 kilometers per second. So suppose you were to be a skeptic and say that in our galactic center there is a clump of a million solar masses of weakly interacting particles, which is, say, 100 Schwarzschild radii in radius, and has a velocity dispersion of 20,000 kilometers per second. Okay. Now, what about my argument against that? I think directly not, because we don't have any. Well, except there's some evidence for periodicities or variation on a timescale down to 15 minutes, which would be hard to explain. But then I would have another argument, which is that if you had an object of that kind, then gas would fall into it, stars by dynamical friction would settle into the center of it, and you'd probably make a black hole anyway. So it's hard to imagine that you had a dense cluster of non-interacting particles in the center of our galaxy for the whole lifetime of the galaxy without it having accumulated within it enough material to make a black hole. But I genuinely think that we don't have any compelling arguments for black holes described by the Kerr metric, and that's the importance of firming up things like the X-ray astronomy data, understanding better the flow patterns around black holes, or if we're very lucky, finding evidence for a star in a relativistic orbit around a black hole where we can see the precession much more neatly, or, of course, by studying the gravitational waveforms and detecting those. But I genuinely think that our belief in the Kerr metric, or Chandrasekhar's belief, and the belief of all of us who follow him, is really based on the fact that we take relativity so seriously in other contexts, and therefore we believe this. But I think it would be hard to convince a skeptic. I should have mentioned there are other effects involving precession, which I didn't go into, which are interesting probes of gas flows, jets that precess, etc. So there are lots of ways in which we could, but the trouble is they all involve rather messy gas dynamics as well, and that prevents you from getting precision tests.
Okay, if you have any more questions for Martin, you'll have to capture him at coffee. Mm-hmm. Can you please be back to start at 11:30 sharp? We thank Martin again.